Recently, along with my colleagues, Nima and Howard Georgi, we have been exploring the physics of a class of four-dimensional field theories, in particular, four-dimensional gauge theories. This class of theories is one that can be associated with a set of silly little pictures. The simplest such picture is a dot like that. To that dot, we associate an arbitrary four-dimensional gauge theory. Some gauge group, doesn't have to be simple, some matter content, fermions, scalars, whatever you like. Slightly more complicated picture consists of two dots, where with the first dot, we continue to associate an arbitrary gauge theory, and with the second dot, an arbitrary independent gauge theory. By independent, I just mean that none of the fields charged under this gauge group are also charged under this one. So with the exception of gravitational interactions, which I will ignore completely for the duration of this talk, these are two totally non-interacting sectors of the world. There is no interaction at all between the fields which live at this point and the ones that live at this point. Well, we'd be here all day if I start going up to the more complicated ones that we've discussed. What makes this interesting is when we start including fields which are charged simultaneously under more than one gauge group. And to represent that, I'll draw a line connecting two of the sites in this graph, where that line corresponds to some set of fields, and again, they may be fermions, bosons, it doesn't matter, which transform according to a non-trivial representation both of the gauge group associated with this site and the gauge group associated with this one. Of course, we can contemplate much more general things, but I'll restrict my attention to theories that can be associated with graphs of only this form according to the rules that I've just given. There's no particular rhyme or reason to how we draw these things. Well, I won't draw that one. But in general, the set of sites and links of this form which characterize our gauge theory, we're calling theory space, and it'll become clear why. Well, why it's called a theory is obvious. Why it's called a space is a little less so, but will become clear as we go along.
So you haven't specified the couplings, interactions yet?
No. Okay, so at the moment, just the charges, right? I should point out that, in fact, any gauge theory, anyone at all, can be described by this notation. After all, that dot was an arbitrary gauge theory. That's, of course, not very interesting. What is interesting is to start with a particular theory space and then see what gauge theories can correspond to that particular theory space. As we'll see, the physics of such things is quite interesting and can encompass a lot of very surprising phenomena. So let's start with a very simple example of a theory space. For example, this one, where the gauge theory at each site is just an SUK gauge group. I'll assume they're all the same. Each link I will associate with a set of fields, say fermions, which are bifundamentals. And that's it. So in fact, these theories in which the gauge groups were all special unitary groups and the links were all bifundamentals were introduced quite a long time ago, both in the phenomenological and more formal literature, where they're called respectively moose diagrams or quiver diagrams. And since this one has been looked at quite a lot, I've just drawn it as an example of an interesting theory space, but rather than trying to work out the physics, let's go on to something which is a little bit more sophisticated than this one. So this theory space is also a Moose diagram. It involves only special unitary groups and bifundamentals. But in this case, I'll take groups of two different types, SUKs, which live on the large open circles, and SUL, living on the small black circles. Again, the links are, I'll assume, fermions, which are bifundamentals. So I'll put arrows to indicate the direction. And I'll assume that there is a symmetry such that all of the gauge couplings for the SUK groups are the same, and all of the gauge couplings for the SUL gauge groups are the same. That is, in fact, a complete specification of this model at renormalizable level. The only interactions allowed by the symmetries and the charges that we've assigned are precisely the gauge interactions. So this is, in fact, where the theory space begins to have some restriction on what's going on in the theory. It's a nice way to summarize the particle content and charge assignments, which in turn restricts the kinds of couplings we can have. Okay, so this theory, under the assumptions that I've stated, is described by two-dimensionless parameters, the coupling constants of the SUK group, which I'll call little g, and the SUL group, which I'll call big G. Of course, for at least some range of K and L, this is an asymptotically free four-dimensional gauge theory. So it's completely well-behaved in the ultraviolet. And we could equally well, by dimensional transmutation, describe things in terms of two-dimensionful parameters, the QCD scales for those SUK and SUL gauge groups. So what I want to do is simply work out the physics of this particular theory at more or less all energy scales. So in order to do that, I'm going to focus on the situation where lambda k is much less than lambda l. Of course, which one I said is much less than the other one is entirely up to you. It's completely symmetric between the two. So the only case that I'm not going to discuss in some detail is what happens when lambda k and lambda l are very close to each other. The physics of that is quite amusing, and if you're interested, we can talk about it later. Okay, so the question is, what does the physics of this theory look like? First, at energies that are large compared to lambda L, the physics is easy. These are asymptotically free gauge theories, so this looks like a bunch of weakly interacting quarks and gluons. As we come down in energy, eventually we reach the scale lambda L. And sometimes I'll write lambda L as 4 pi f. And I'll try to be careful with the 4 pi's. I may slip up occasionally. As we approach this scale, the SUL gauge couplings get strong. But by our assumption, all of the SUK gauge couplings are quite weak. And therefore, in determining what happens, we can ignore those weak gauge couplings and then put them in at a later stage. So in the limit where we ignore those gauge couplings, I should have said that we're going to have the gauge group of this thing is, we'll have n of the open circles and n of the closed circles. So in the limit where we ignore the SUK gauge interactions, this looks like n copies of a simple theory, which is an SUL gauge theory with K flavors. But of course, we know the physics of that theory extremely well. It's just a copy of QCD. So that means that each one of these pieces of the theory space, this gauge coupling gets strong, these fermions condense, they break the chiral symmetries associated with those K flavors. So I can write the condensate as 4 pi f cubed by dimensions. And then, of course, there is a unitary matrix which says which direction in the flavor space this points.
But in strict speaking, a signal to be CD, but could be different, right, in terms of I would agree that it's not for sure, right?
Well, there could be special cases.
It requires that K is small enough, otherwise you're like a formal issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm restricting K and L to some range where I'm not in the conformal regime, where I'm in the asymptotically free regime, and I don't want to take them particularly too small as well. There may be special flavor cases
but
as well.
Right, the dynamic which makes this condensation.
Yes, absolutely.
You get conformal regime before you lose asymptotic freedom.
Yes, I'm sorry, absolutely. Yeah. But so just stay away from that regime for what I have to say. Okay. Well, of course, when this gauge coupling gets strong, in addition to producing the Goldstone bosons associated with the chiral symmetry breaking, there is a spectrum of massive hadrons with masses characteristically of size lambda and glue balls or whatever else. But let's look at the physics now below the scale lambda L, where we can integrate out those degrees of freedom and not worry about it.
So you have just whatever number of disconnected QCDs, right?
Correct. Okay,
they don't interact. But when you switch off this,
when you switch off this group, this other group, they don't interact.
They don't interact.
Right. But so now in the theory, the effective theory at energies below lambda L, I'm going to switch back on those gauge couplings and just write down the effective Lagrangian. It of course is described now only by the light modes left over from here, the Goldstone bosons in the limit when I switched off the couplings, plus the gauge interactions. So of course that means that the effective theory is a gauged nonlinear signal model.
Many sigma models.
Many sigma models.
Many couple sigma models.
Correct. So there are the kinetic terms associated with the SUK gauge bosons. There are, of course, n of them. There is the usual sigma model kinetic term, where those are now covariant derivatives, including the gauge interactions. And of course, there is a tower of higher dimension operators. But since I'm going to be considering what happens at scales below lambda L, the contribution to the physics of these higher dimension operators can be safely ignored.
And SU would be matrix in SUK, right?
U is a K by K unitary matrix.
Yeah.
Right. So for the covariant derivative, well, that's the ordinary derivative. Remember, these fermions have condensed to produce the Goldstone bosons, so they transform like a fundamental under this SUK and an empty fundamental under this SUK on the right. So the covariant derivative is plus I A mu for the jth site, uj, minus I uj a j plus 1. Okay, the minus sign because fundamental versus anti-fundamental. Okay. And that's it. That's the effective action. But remember, our goal was to figure out what the physics of this theory is at more or less all energy scales. We've dealt with above here. What about below here? What's the physics of this effective theory? In fact, it requires absolutely no effort to say precisely what the physics is, because we can simply look at this and recognize it as a lattice 5B Yang-Mills action, where we've latticized one direction only, one spatial direction. Having realized that that's all this theory is, we can now read off from this Lagrangian what our lattice parameters are. For example, the lattice spacing is 1 over GF. And I'll get to the other parameters in a minute. But in particular, then, for energies much less than the lattice spacing, 1 over A, of course, we can't distinguish this theory from a continuum five-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. We can also read off the five-dimensional gauge coupling for that theory. From our action, and not surprisingly, it is simply 1 over g squared in units of the lattice spacing. That is just f over g, sorry.
This is 5D compact.
Yes.
With a lattice of n size.
Right. So as we'll see in a second, anticipating the radius is n times the lattice spacing A. So when n is large, there's indeed a regime where it looks like the continuum 5D theory. If n is not large, there isn't. Right?
Just to follow, I don't understand where you see this, you know, this computified five dimension. You know, you have this expression, right?
I have this expression, yes.
Yeah, and it is, you know, this chiral Lagrangian, right? With some number of vector fields included. Right?
Yes.
In terms of, I mean, normal four dimension, right?
Yes.
If you go from five dimensions. That you mean the sum, it tells you that it is...
You see, U is this, U's link matrix.
Yeah,
right. U is the link matrix. The only thing he has to do to rewrite the first term, F.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking about. So you mean the first term would be corresponding to that... But it's a kind of, it's five fields dimension, which is...
Let's be careful for a second. So first of all, we've latticized one dimension.
Normally,
when you latticize all the dimensions, let me just go on. When you latticize all the dimensions, in order to get the usual gauge kinetic term, you include plaquettes.
Uh-huh.
Right? But we have, since we've only latticized one dimension, we really only need that one part of the gauge kinetic terms, namely F5 mu squared. That comes precisely from this term here, okay? And so we need to incorporate the other parts of the gauge kinetic terms directly. Okay.
Yeah, but in this way, it's just along this direction, you have just n degrees of freedom, that's it, right? I mean, in a sense, I mean, like n points. So you can say that it is a lattice, but it would be helpful when if you go to the limit of large n, right?
Yes.
Because otherwise, I mean, it's...
Absolutely. Okay, but... So, great. So the five-dimensional gauge coupling F over G, no problem. Well, so just to make this correspondence convincing, and because these formulas may be of use later, let's work out the mass spectrum of this theory. So rather than thinking about it as a latticized 5D theory, we can just think about it as the gauge nonlinear sigma model. The coupling G is weak. We can just do perturbation theory, that is classical physics at this level, tree-level physics, and work out the spectrum by going to an appropriate gauge for these unitary matrices or figuring out what the vacuum is. Indeed, it's when they're all unit matrices. And then you just work out the gauge boson spectrum. Of course, there are n SUK adjoint multiplets. We're not breaking the SUK. So actually, m squared of k, that's not the same k. K is a label. And just with the normalizations and various things I've chosen, sine squared pi k over n.
This comes from the lattice size or from the sigma model side?
Just this Lagrangian, so the sigma model side. You just take it, you find the vacuum, which is the unitary matrices all one, you diagonalize the quadratic part of the action, this is what you get.
Okay.
Okay.
Is there ever a case where the instead of being the identity matrix, you get the eigenvalues arranged in a circle?
There are other vacua, in which not in general that one. In this case, it doesn't happen. But we'll, in fact, see some cases. Hopefully, if I get there, where you get other interesting patterns. Okay. You also, well, just to anticipate, there are cases, of course, where there are degenerate vacua with where the U's take on a set of values sometimes characterized by Zn, which are kind of interesting.
Assuming the subscript K, what it labels? Is it the same as an SUK or?
No, it's a label which runs from 1 to n, labeling the different mass eigenstates.
So in this sense, the symmetry is lost, right? SUK symmetry, because they are non-degenerate, SUK symmetry is...
So each of these is, there are cases, an unfortunate notation.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Does that help?
Okay.
Okay. There are k squared minus one particles at each mass level of spin one. Okay.
So is there a normal representation?
Yes. Okay. Right. So in particular, first of all, the sinusoidal spectrum is no big surprise. That's what you get from a lattice. We can make this look a little bit more fifth dimensional by defining a momentum in the fifth direction, where P5 is just 2 pi r over nA. So you can just plug in, that's the same expression in a slightly different way, or 2 pi r n, let me just leave it like that for the moment. And in particular, from this identification, you see, as was anticipated a few moments ago, that this is not just a latticized Yang-Mills theory with lattice spacing A, but one that has been compactified on a circle of radius NA.
Well, it's like temperature in the fifth dimension, right?
Yeah.
Well,
it's a circle.
Well, in Euclidean case, this would
be... Like, well, you still have Minkowski time, right? It's just, it's a circle.
Yeah, okay.
Sometimes we live on circles. There are no fermions anymore. Okay, so of course, what this means, if we really want to see something that looks like continuum five-dimensional physics, since we all know that a five-dimensional theory compactified on a circle at energy scales small compared to the inverse circle radius, it looks four-dimensional again. If n is not large, there's no regime in which it really looks five-dimensional, but if n is large, no problem.
Subtle is like a different kind of vector in this case, because you know normally in a standard kind of Lagrangian, all vector are equivalent, right? You can choose a here is the same way or
right. In this case, there is no ambiguity.
You know what I mean,
yes, I know exactly. This was asked a minute ago. In this case, there's no ambiguity. We'll see other cases where there are different vacua. Hopefully, we'll see them. I don't quite know. Okay, so. Just to be completely clear, I've said it two different ways. Let's say it a third different way. Let's look at the spectrum as a function of P5. That is the energy of these modes. And I'll just choose zero ordinary spatial momentum, so that energy is the same as the mass. And it really is a lattice. P5 extends from minus pi over A to pi over A. That's the first Brillouin zone. If you look in regions where P5 is much less than 1 over A, there are such regions if N is large. Of course, you're on the linear part of this spectrum, which is to say M is P5, or including the four-dimensional momentum, E squared is P squared plus P5 squared. That is the correct dispersion relation for the five-dimensional field.
This dispersion relation, even for n goes to infinity, right?
Yes.
Only holds for low energies.
Correct.
So what happened?
Well,
if n is infinity, at low energies, this looks like a five-dimensional theory.
Right.
If you go to higher energies,
as n, we'll come to this in detail. In fact, I'm just about to write it. But as n goes to infinity, that takes the radius to infinity, but it keeps the lattice spacing fixed.
Right.
So it still looks like a latticized five-dimensional theory on a line now. Okay, which is to say, at low energies, that looks like the continuum five-dimensional theory. But if you start doing physics at higher energies, you notice it's not really a five-dimensional theory.
And presumably, but there are also corrections to the kind of Lagrangian.
Absolutely. Okay.
Four-dimensional.
Right. So that's, of course, when you first start noticing that it wasn't really a five-dimensional theory. So let's, in fact, make a little plot of the various scales here and say what the physics is at the different scales. So first, notice that the lightest mode here for large n let's just do large N, has a mass which is GF over N. Mass is GF over N, and note, GF over N is also the radius. There is a tower of modes evenly spaced, just as the KK modes from a five-dimensional theory compactified on a circle. Those modes start getting more closely spaced as we approach the top here. The top of the tower, the mass is GF, up to factors of 2, which I'm not being careful about. That, of course, is 1 over the lattice spacing. So indeed, we have the N modes, which go from 1 over R to 1 over the lattice spacing. Note that at this scale, GF, remember I've assumed that G is weak at the scale lambda L. Perturbation theory is still good. So the physics is still nice and weakly coupled here. No problem at all. We haven't reached the scale where, for example, the higher dimension operators become important here, or those heavy states that we integrated out. But we've already noticed that it wasn't precisely the continuous fifth dimension. We've already started seeing the fact that it was this lattice. And then above this scale, well, if we keep going up, eventually we reach the scale 4 pi f, which at least for weak coupling is substantially above this, where finally we notice that there are all these extra states, and in fact a better description of energies above this scale is precisely the weakly interacting four-dimensional gauge bosons and fermions. Okay, I should have pointed out that there is in fact one massless SUK gauge boson left, R equals 0 here. There is one unbroken SUK gauge symmetry, and we'll come back to that in a second. Okay. So, hopefully the physics of this is completely clear now. Let's make a couple of comments.
But this one which is unbroken, is it coupled too, or?
Is it?
No, I mean, the one which is unbroken, it is also coupled to it.
Yes, so the one that's unbroken, it's a non-abelian SUK gauge symmetry.
Yeah.
So it's got self-couplings, and in addition, these heavier states transform like adjoints under that SUK gauge symmetry.
And in addition, there's one left every year.
Is it easy to have many extra dimensions instead of one?
Yes.
And you can make a sphere as well as a circle?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, just repeating what I've said, for energies much less than 1 over A, what we have managed to construct here is a 5D Yang-Mills gauge theory, well, Yang-Mills theory on a circle. Okay. Of radius R. And of course, at energies much less than 1 over R, that goes back to being a four-dimensional gauge theory. In fact, we know what the coupling of a five-dimensional Yang-Mills theory compactified on a circle should be. Here's the five-dimensional coupling. So we just have to multiply by R to get the four-dimensional coupling. So that four-dimensional coupling, G squared Yang-Mills, is just G5 squared over R, which, plugging in the formulas over there, is just G squared over N. And, of course, that's a result we could have gotten without ever mentioning the words extra dimension. We break the SUK to the N symmetry down to the diagonal subgroup. There were N such groups, each with gauge coupling G. The coupling of the diagonal subgroup is G squared over N, just as it should be.
Are there any Skirmion-type solutions in the low energy Lagrangian? Skirmion-type solutions?
In general, yes. Well, so in this case, at weak coupling, their masses are all well above the scale at which this theory no longer looks five-dimensional, so you don't have to worry about them. Okay, but hold that thought. Okay. The second comment is that a 5D gauge theory has a dimensional coupling. And as such, a five-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, a real five-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, isn't well-defined. you have to specify some procedure for dealing with the physics above the characteristic scale set by that coupling, where the theory isn't well defined. In perhaps an old-fashioned language, we would say it's non-renormalizable.
But your kernel theory, you know, effective kernel theory is not renormalizable by itself.
Correct.
But
the theory I started with is a completely well-defined, renormalizable, and even asymptotically free field theory. Its physics in the UV is perfectly well-defined. So we have a theory which is defined at all energies, no problem at all, and yet at low energies is indistinguishable from the five-dimensional gauge theory. So that is a UV completion of a five-dimensional gauge theory.
Excuse me, if you are in this energy range where you think you are in five-dimensional theory, it's still confining theory, right? Because it's non-Iberian, right?
Yes, except the confinement scale.
Yeah.
Remember that the coupling of the unbroken gauge theory is g squared over n.
Okay.
So the confinement scale is way below any of the scales we've talked about here, including 1 over r.
Below in coordinate space or
in energy scale?
In energy.
So okay. It's almost non-confined.
Correct. So
it's a very weak confinement.
It's a very weak confinement. So the confinement radius is enormous.
It's okay. Just a statement. Five-dimensional theory, which is weakly coupled, it's kind of
awful.
So it gets more weakly coupled.
Correct.
Down
the way it becomes coordinate,
and then
it becomes
coupled.
Right. Okay.
So you can never go to a strongly coupled five-dimensional theory.
Yeah.
It's like, oh.
Correct. But
yes,
but,
okay.
but just wait.
Just wait.
Presumably this isn't unique, in that you can make other constructions which give you the same, looks like the same five-dimensional.
Absolutely.
Low energies, and it's different UV.
Absolutely.
Even standard QCD, it's also effective in Kyle limit. It is non-normalizable theory, but non-QCD is normalizable theory, right?
Correct.
But
you wouldn't have said that about a five-dimensional gauge theory. Right, you say that about QCD because it's a renormalizable theory.
Five-dimensional theory is like chiral theory in that case, right? Because your five-dimensional theory is essentially
in
four dimensions.
So let's once again state what happened. We started with a theory which was renormalizable, asymptotically free in four dimensions, and discovered that its physics at low energies was indistinguishable from that of the five-dimensional gauge theory.
Well,
okay,
that's good.
Right. It's good. Okay, so this provides a UV completion of 5D gauge theory. That is one possibility for what happens to the physics before the five-dimensional gauge theory breaks down, or before it becomes strongly coupled, is it ceases looking like the five-dimensional gauge theory. It looks like a four-dimensional theory, which has much better UV behavior.
No, but this completion is in this way four-dimensional, right? Because
yes,
in this way, it would be five-dimensional also, the way it would be non-minimalizable.
Correct.
No, but that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Low energy totally fakes.
Yeah.
Five-dimensional. I mean, as long as you don't measure high-dimensional operators,
yeah,
the dispersion law is totally five-dimensional, everything is okay. But then, all the high energies you discover, that's not the case. The world is four-dimensional. Or maybe even at low dimensions, if you have very precision measurements, right? You discover the corrections.
Right.
And then you say, aha, I know the corrections are because the theory is not truly five-dimensional.
It makes it hard to discover extra dimensions.
No,
on the contrary, yeah.
No, but the spectrum is such as when you run
Okay, so the language that we are using to describe this phenomena is that the theory space, I should have said, the theory space, remember, was this circle, and in fact that circle, which was just a description of the particle content of a four-dimensional theory, is now a picture of the spatial dimension that's appeared. So in this case, we say the theory space has deconstructed a spatial dimension. In fact, the locality of interactions in the five-dimensional gauge theory is nothing more than the locality of the interactions that we put in our theory space. The fact that we didn't have objects which were charged simultaneously under all of the different gauge groups, but only under nearest neighbor pairs is what became, in this limit, the locality of interactions in the five-dimensional theory. So, in fact, the locality of theory space is what became the locality of the spatial dimension. And that's why theory spaces are an interesting set of objects to consider, because we now have a very simple tool which allows us to build four-dimensional gauge theories which have a notion of locality in theory space and interaction space built in. In some circumstances, that locality, as we saw here, became precisely the locality of a spatial dimension. In other cases, it doesn't look anything like a spatial dimension, but nevertheless, that locality remains intact and provides us with a lot of interesting physics.
Yeah, but in terms of kind of physical signature, I understand means that what you say corresponds to the fact that you have kind of exodegeneracy, right? In a sense, in your four-dimensional model, you have this exodegeneracy which relatively accommodates, you know, in correspondence with five-dimensional, right? Because, you know, this extra, this number of states you got there, you can interpret them as, you know, five-dimensional. So in terms of four-dimensional, it means that you have much more degenerate states than if you would normally think about four-dimensional.
So indeed, if we want to have the spectrum of a five-dimensional theory, we better have the right particle content to describe that spectrum. But the point that I'm making here is that it isn't simply a matter of replicating these gauge groups in order to obtain the five-dimensional theory. The locality of interactions here was crucial for that to happen. If we had incorporated objects which were charged simultaneously under all of those things, this would have had the same number of degrees of freedom, well, more, because I've added that extra link, but wouldn't look anything like a fifth dimension. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying only a very special moves behaves.
Well, so the key feature is locality of interactions. But even in cases where we have locality of interactions, there will be many cases, in fact more interesting than this one, which don't look like an extra dimension. But nevertheless, that locality of interactions lets you do very interesting things. Okay?
So it's just like you get a non-local interaction in fifth dimension.
If you were to stick in an extra link, precisely.
You put a link across.
Absolutely.
It would just be something so funny.
But it could very much look like a fifth dimension, except there's this...
With extra non-local terms.
Small.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely.
That's
you can do all sorts of things like
you
that.
You can look for that at fifth dimension.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, you had a comment you want to
make? Yeah, so in this simple theory, if we try to make it look like the five-dimensional theory all the way up. I'm sorry, you're about to
don't make that comment, please.
All right. I thought you weren't going to say it.
I'm not right now, but I will. If I don't, I'll call on you again. Okay.
But if you want to say make an interesting singularity, and that's what I'm thinking,
yes,
you could do that by embellishing some of those.
Precisely. So, in fact, now that you brought that up, why don't we say it now? What if you want to make an orbifold? Deconstruct an orbifold.
Or something that's not understood.
Well, so that's really easy. You know that at an orbifold, one of the things you do is you project out some of the modes, maybe some that would live at the fixed point. So let's say I want to make this a fixed point. I could reduce the gauge symmetry there. That's an orbifold. Okay, we'll see some more sophisticated examples than that, but that's the basic point.
What do? You remove the gauge group there?
I reduced it, for example, so that I projected out some of the degrees of freedom.
Smaller gauge.
Right. Now, that doesn't necessarily correspond to any orbifold that anyone has ever played with for good reason, but we'll see. Hopefully, maybe not.
But you could have this happen spontaneously by some Higgs mechanism or something.
Sure, absolutely.
Through different phases.
Absolutely.
So can you construct a fourth dimension or three dimension by lower dimensional field theory?
Absolutely. Okay. Now, there are technical issues which are different in going from some number of dimensions to some other number of dimensions. For example, I will point out here that we started with the five-dimensional gauge theory. When we went down to four, our original theory was completely renormalizable. Right? So you have to ask whether that continues to hold. If you tried to go from six dimensions down to five, well, of course, your five-dimensional theory wouldn't be renormalizable.
Transitions where the topology of the extra dimensions change.
Absolutely.
And is there anything special about extra dimensional geometries which solve Einstein's equation?
Nothing.
We haven't put in
any gravity at all.
No, I understand.
Okay. But even if you put in only four-dimensional gravity, if you don't make any attempt at deconstructing five-dimensional general relativity, then it's a moot point.
But can I just ask, how literally should we take this? I mean, if I replace that circle by some manifold, and I triangulate that manifold,
yep.
and I put sort of groups on that,
yep. Yep. Yep.
is
yep.
the
yep.
extra dimension going to have the sort of topology?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. 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 Want to do a Klein bottle?
Yeah.
No problem.
And it will have the geometry of the manifold? I mean,
well,
the geometry means
you put
it in exactly what values you give for the
link fields.
For
right.
Those
right. So, for example, doesn't matter.
Okay.
Yeah.
And topological transitions are very
sure.
easy. Just links go to zero, for example.
But,
yeah. We're talking about cutting holes in the manifold.
It may be really interesting if those transitions actually occurred on BrainPro, for example, in a real theory. Many of these models come out on BrainPro, but not most of them. It's the ones that show topology change versus also the exist.
Okay. So at least. Well, so I have about 15 minutes left. I'm going to go in a particular direction, although there are other directions which various members of the audience might find more entertaining. So I'll mention those in a minute. But I really wanted to emphasize that in this case, we have used theory space to deconstruct an extra dimension. And as this discussion has shown, pretty much any phenomenon that you can think of, as long as it doesn't depend crucially on gravity, can be deconstructed in this way. You can find a four-dimensional field theory which has all of that physics at low energies, and that's a very interesting direction to go, especially when you start incorporating supersymmetry, and I'll make some comments about that shortly. But what I wanted to emphasize is that this locality of interactions in theory space does interesting things even when it doesn't deconstruct an extra dimension. And so I want to mention a few of those applications since they're probably a little bit less familiar. So, as a simple example, which is of some phenomenological interest, we can use this locality to produce naturally light scalars. And in particular, we can use this to produce realistic models of electroweak symmetry breaking. And I'm not going to describe the details of such a model, but I'll just describe the basic mechanism that's at work. So the physical analogy is pretty clear. Note that if we were to try to deconstruct a spatial dimension, if we could make an object like a scalar field which was extended in a spatial dimension, then its couplings soften at high energies just with a form factor. Well, that's kind of hard to do in general, but the locality of theory space does the same thing as locality of a spatial dimension, even when the physics doesn't look much like a spatial dimension. In particular, if we can extend our scalar field in theory space, rather than having it localized at one of these points, but extended, that also softens its physics at high energies, in just the same way as a spatial extent would. In fact, that's already happened in this model, which is what Matt was pointing out earlier. In this model, it happens to look like it's extended in the spatial dimension, but in a moment I'll draw some theory spaces which don't look anything like a spatial dimension, but still have these extended objects. So in describing the spectrum of this theory, I said, well, we're going to set all the unitary matrices, the U sub j, equal to 1. In fact, there are n SUK gauge groups, so I have a lot of gauge freedom. Setting some of them to 1 is just a gauge choice. But there is a diagonal SUK which is unbroken. So I can set n minus 1 of the U's to something by using the gauge freedom, but there's one remaining U which is a physical degree of freedom.
But you have a global because you know a gauge symmetry it is this diagonal, but you have also not gauge but global symmetry in your spectrum too when you said that it's k squared minus 1.
That's just because they form representations of the unbroken SUK gauge symmetry.
Ah, it's gauge. Right. So there's right. no extra global symmetry.
No. So in particular, I can always choose a gauge where all of the link fields are equal to each other. And since these are unitary matrices, I can write it as e to the I phi over root n, where phi is an adjoint. at tree level, the Lagrangian I wrote earlier, this object is massless. It looks something like a Goldstone boson. However, there is no symmetry which protects its mass. I can write down operators which, in fact, give it a mass. And indeed, in the low-energy theory, remember this came from a renormalizable field theory, so in the low-energy theory, we will induce such operators with a natural size that we can get by standard power counting arguments. So in fact...
You just said all the symmetries are local. So there are no pseudo-Goldstones?
No.
There are
no pseudo-Goldstones. Okay. The object I'm describing currently is vaguely similar, but not exactly the same as a pseudo-Goldstone. Okay? It depends a little bit on what you define as a pseudo, but the standard definition does not include this.
But here it's like
this.
You introduce a massive pattern, right? I mean, you're saying that you can introduce, you know, Kyle...
Wait. Okay, the leading operator, which is consistent with the gauge symmetries of this theory, which gives rise to a mass of this object, which will be induced in the low-energy theory, is something which looks like a trace of the product of all the u's, that's gauge invariant, mod squared. And the natural size for its coefficient, well, note that if we set any one of those weak SUK gauge couplings to 0, there would be an exact chiral symmetry. This would be an exact Goldstone boson. This operator would be forbidden. Not surprisingly, it involves a line of the u's around the circle. So in fact, the natural size for its coefficient is simply g squared over 16 pi squared.
Pi squared, let's consider one u. For one u, you're introducing trace u, for example, normally.
Trace u is not gauge invariant. It transforms like one group on the left and a different group on the right.
Right, it's breaks.
I don't want to break gauge invariant.
I see.
Sorry.
Can you do the kind of, I'm confused.
Yeah, let me write the answer.
Each gauge group has ek squared minus 1.
Correct. Right? Each link is described by k squared minus 1.
Right.
They're unitary matrices. Right.
So
lives in the adjoint.
Left with one Goldstone per link, one massless guy, not even.
No.
How many unequals per link?
All.
There's an extra singular field, but they're not both.
Oh, okay. So there's one unequal.
There is k squared minus 1. This is it.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. This is the operator that's induced in the low energy theory. It does indeed depend on the details of the high energy theory, but note that since G is a weak coupling and is large, this is an incredibly tiny mass. This is a completely naturally light scalar in this low energy theory.
When you have this gauge invariant theory, that in a minimal, if it would be a minimal amount of matter there, then it means that, you know, this this original Goldstone boson would be eaten up by your gauge field, right? And every field becomes massive. So you said that essentially part of this happened, right? Because some of your gauge
some, but not all,
massive, but not all of them. So what before you're discussing the storm, you have your spectrum where you have some number already massive vector fields. Let's forget them. Okay. So let's leave only what is massless. So you have massless gauge bosons. Do you have massless scalar fields as well?
The spectrum of the theory is precisely what I've said it is. We have an SUK gauge multiplet, and we have these k squared minus 1 extremely light scalars. That's it.
So they're not assuming they're just masses, right?
No, they have a mass. There is this.
But in the limit of large n, their mass goes to 0, right?
Yes.
Okay, so that...
So, and since we want to have large n, their mass...
Wait, whoa. I said, you remember, that our goal here was to not deconstruct an extra dimension. There's no reason to take large N unless you're interested in recovering that extra-dimensional physics, and I'm not. I only require locality of the interactions in order to reduce the mass. So I'm not going to take large N. Maybe I'll take N equals 3.
So you do not have mass. Second speaking, you do not have massless scalar fields in your theory, right?
Correct.
I see. So there is not that you can, make kind of Higgs mechanism for
We will.
This is the degree of freedom associated with a Wilson lie.
Correct. So in this case, where you do consider the large n limit, this is deconstructing a fifth dimension, and so you should be able to interpret the physics of this object in a five-dimensional language, and it is nothing other than the scalar degree of freedom associated with the Wilson line. Indeed, you can check, well, I won't even do it.
Explain the fact that g squared to n again, I missed that.
So in order to get this operator, imagine, take the Moose diagram. Okay. Imagine setting any one of the SUK gauge couplings to zero, different from the others.
Oh, okay. Then once gone. Yeah. So then we just.
Okay.
But in terms of 40 parameters and radius,
don't worry about that because we're going to go away from that limit anyway. I'll show you later. Okay. Remember, we're not trying to deconstruct an extra dimension. I'm just describing how locality can lead to a naturally light scalar. What we're really interested in. Guess what? A model of electroweak symmetry breaking, and I don't want it to look like an extra dimension for that to work. So you'll see. But it's not going to be this theory, so don't worry about that. Let me go. Okay. In fact, this is not. So this operator produces a tiny mass for this scalar. That's not the mass that the scalar actually has in this theory. That's the part, the contribution of its mass, which comes from the ultraviolet. But in fact, in this theory, there's an infrared contribution as well, which doesn't depend on the UV physics and is larger than this, at least for n bigger than 2, and completely calculable. That comes just from a Coleman-Weinberg potential. So remember, this is not a Goldstone boson. It's not even a pseudo-Goldstone boson. So nothing prevents.
No, but when it's light, it's very similar to it, right? Because you are saying that it's really light, and you have some extra potential. Then it reminds the situation which you
okay. have said. Let's postpone the discussion about whether it is or is not a pseudo-Goldstone boson, because I think the physics of the object is clear.
The question is whether you can get a not Higgs type of phase.
And they can.
And
the thing that makes it interesting is that before it was six. It was hard to come up with models of pseudo-boson bosons with gauge couplings and power couplings and quark-soft interactions. Pseudo-boson bosons don't have couplings like that. These objects have exactly couples that derive like that. And you can build it on the list of Higgs models. But with no supersymmetry and all that.
Let's get the factors right. None of this is important. I don't know why I'm writing it.
That's a 9.
That's a 9. Actually, it's a Q. No, it's a 9. Sorry. I think I got it right. Little n. Okay. But there's a reason I'm writing it down. Plus a constant. That sum goes to infinity. It really does. Okay. Note that this, just by expanding, has a quadratic term, which gives rise to a mass squared for phi, which goes like g fourth f squared. If n is bigger than 2, that is more important than this. Okay, so there's a tiny contribution to the mass of this scalar from high energies, but there's a more important and completely calculable infrared contribution coming from here.
So just to say, so if you're going to do perturbation theory, only at n loops would you find a quadratic divergence of this minuscule coefficient.
Right.
Way before n loops, you'll just get a finite calculable.
But you call it mass, but this mass could be negative as well.
Absolutely, it could be. Yeah. In this case, for n bigger than 2, it turns out to be positive, but it could be negative, and that's what's interesting.
But this right. formula only holds for n bigger than 2?
Yeah. This formula only holds for n bigger than 2. Yeah.
There's a log divergence.
Right. Okay, so... this, of course, just came from doing a one-loop diagram. As we argued up here, you'll never see a divergence for n bigger than 2 in that one-loop diagram. So that's why you get this. Now, of course, if you had just taken this scalar, which in principle could have hard couplings or whatnot, you might ask, how did it miraculously happen that those divergences canceled? Well, they're in here. So they don't cancel, as in supersymmetry in the calculation of the potential. They cancel in the phi-dependent part of the Coleman-Weinberg potential. In fact, that's rather easy to see directly from the mass spectrum. The easy way to calculate the Coleman-Weinberg potential is to turn on a background phi that affects the masses of this spectrum of massive gauge bosons, and then we just compute trace m squared times the cutoff squared plus trace m to the fourth log m squared over cutoff squared. So I said I wrote these down for a reason. When you turn on the background phi, that's what happens to the spectrum. So the quadratically divergent part goes like the sum on k, R, sum on R of m squared. And guess what? The sum on R of sine squared is a number, independent of that argument. So it does not depend on phi. So there is indeed a quadratic divergence, but it's not a contribution to the scalar mass. It's a contribution to the cosmological constant.
Andy, I mean, this is, of course, a very nice argument, except that somehow it's too strong. It's not strong enough. We've only used locality. So this must be true even if you don't have exact translation symmetry.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So how do the spectrum be different? How do you show that?
Okay.
For arbitrary couplings.
Great. Excellent. So I'm almost out of time. Let me finish this. I'll answer your question and then I'll stop. Actually, the sum on R of sine squared pi over n plus a constant is a constant. Okay. Write it as complex exponentials. Do the sum.
Yeah,
this is all obvious from the mass matrix. There's a log divergence, which is sum on R of m to the fourth. That's also independent of phi. Somewhat less easy to see, but is also obvious from the mass matrix. Okay, I should say, if you write down the mass matrix, the only phi dependence is coming on off-diagonal terms in the mass squared matrix, so its trace obviously doesn't depend on it. When you square it, there's still off-diagonal terms, its trace doesn't depend on it. Eventually, you get to a high enough power where you get things on the diagonal, and that's where the divergence comes from. Okay, so once again, the physics of this is really, in this case, we really did have an extra dimension. This is an extended object in the extra dimension, like the Wilson line, and of course, that's why its mass is protected. But once again, we don't have to go to the limit where we really deconstruct an extra dimension. We don't have to take n large. We don't have to take something which has translational invariance. And that means that we can engineer, without too much trouble, a model which has a scalar field, which is an adjoint under SU2, and naturally gets its VEV and produces a model of electroweak symmetry breaking. So let me just draw a theory space that does that. In doing so, I'll hopefully answer Matt's question. Then I'll just make some comments about other interesting things you can do, and then I'll stop. So this is a theory space which includes four sites, 1, 2, 3, 4, 8 links, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And I'm assuming that this is attached over here, this is attached over here, this is attached here, this is attached here. So indeed, the topology of this theory space is a torus with, well, I'm going to put a different gauge group here from the others, so it's a torus with a puncture, if you like. But, of course, since I only have four sites and eight links, there's no regime in which it's going to look like an extra dimension. But still, it's got four sites, eight links, and it has, in fact, at low energies, objects similar to this. In fact, it has two. That's not a big surprise. It's a torus. So there are what would have looked like in the limit where it deconstructed extra dimensions, the two independent Wilson lines. They are light scalars of exactly this type. They get a contribution from the UV. Well, in this case, because the number of sites is only four, there's actually a logarithmic contribution from the UV, which isn't important, is not very important for building a realistic model of electroweak symmetry breaking. If you're unhappy about the log divergence, well, you could just increase the number of sites to 9, and then the logarithmic divergence is gone as well. What did I want to say? if we put, so over here, the object which looked like the Wilson line, this light, naturally light scalar field, was an adjoint under the unbroken gauge group. But that's not what we want for electroweak symmetry breaking. We want a doublet. So in fact, if we make these sites SU3, the unbroken gauge symmetry at low energies before considerations of these scalars is just SU2 cross U1, the diagonal SU2 cross U1. There are then two, because of the two cycles, light things which are naively adjoints under the SU3 symmetry, but of course that's broken by the physics of that special site where it's only SU2 cross U1, so that decomposes into doublets, singlets, and triplets. In fact, the singlet and the triplets get masses. There are various symmetries associated with this theory space, I should have said. There is a D4 non-abelian symmetry, actually just corresponds to the 90-degree rotations and reflection of the theory space, which when we add fermion couplings is broken down to Z4. There's an exact Z4 discrete symmetry, which guarantees that the triplet and the singlets are no phenomenological problem at all. Finally, incorporating fermions, the contribution to the Coleman-Weimer potential for these scalars from the top quark has the property that it produces a negative mass squared for one of them and drives electroweak symmetry breaking, much as in the MSSM. Okay, since I'm already a little bit over time, I don't want to go into the details of the physics of this model. I will just say that I think...
So this last remark is an answer to Feinstein's question that the mass, there's no reason for...
There's no reason for the mass, absolutely, positive. Precisely.
So in your calculation, somehow it came out positive.
Well, here it just happened to come out positive. Note that if n equals 2, it would have come out negative.
But for some reason, the top quark gives a negative contribution.
Yeah, not for some reason, the usual reason, just as in the MSSM.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I just wanted to first make a couple of comments about how great I think these models are. We're, in fact, at the moment finishing up a paper describing the beginning of the phenomenology of it. It is a completely technically natural model of electroweak symmetry breaking. Of course, it requires a UV completion. That is, at the moment, all I've done is describe things at the nonlinear sigma model level, but the scale, 4 pi f for that nonlinear sigma model, is well above a TeV, somewhere parametrically between 10 and 100 TeV. So the question of UV completing it is now completely decoupled from electroweak symmetry breaking. In fact, there's one trivial way of UV completing it, which is just to supersymmetrize it. Note that that's much easier than the MSSM because the supersymmetry is no longer connected in any way with electroweak symmetry breaking.
Sorry, where do you have to put in supersymmetry?
I have a nonlinear sigma model at the moment.
Right.
Okay. That theory becomes strongly coupled at the scale 4 pi f.
Oh, so you need
I got to do something. So I can make it a linear sigma model, but that's not technically natural. I could fix that with supersymmetry, but at that high scale, so not for the electroweak
right.
symmetry breaking.
So in this picture, from the picture you described before, you added fermions, except for the top quark, which does something about the electroweak breaking.
Yes.
All the other quarks in the lepton just go along for the ride. They don't do anything.
Exactly right.
There's a very weakly couple.
There's no pressure change.
Yeah. Precisely. Okay. So first of all, technically natural. It has new physics, which we're not bothering to specify, somewhere between 10 and 100 TeV. Mm-hmm. It has a new set of particles. Note that the spectrum of gauge bosons, for example, here is, although not exactly the same as the spectrum in the circle, includes those excitations corresponding to the extra SU3 gauge groups. They have masses which are on the order of the TeV scale, and indeed it's their contribution which is coming in to cancel the quadratic divergence of the Higgs. So there is a cancellation of the quadratic divergence without supersymmetry here.
Excuse me.
Yes.
When you don't speak of this deconstruction and don't send them to infinity,
yes.
It's like a special version of Technicolor models, right?
Well, except we're not producing the condensate with strong dynamics here.
Yeah, but
I'm just starting with the nonlinear sigma model.
The idea that you have a strongly coupled gauge group somewhere at high energies.
There's no assumption here that there's a strongly coupled gauge group at high energies. None of this physics depends on what's happening at corporate.
It's somewhere else, right? But
no, it isn't even necessarily somewhere else.
Yes.
This could be UV completed at the scale where all the couplings are still weak, right? No strong couplings anywhere. So the physics of electroweak symmetry breaking here, as in the MSSM, is completely perturbative There's no strong dynamics, so you don't run into problems with S, for example, and
things
like that.
Yeah, but you also, like in technical, in principle, you have new particles which you can discover, right?
And the MSSM has new particles which you can discover, too. That's not specific to technical.
But it's different, right, in this case.
But it's all perturbative here.
It's all perturbative. I think that that's...
No, I mean, it's kind of new physics comes into play at some scale anyway, right? I mean,
well, that's always the case.
Yeah,
otherwise, you can't solve the hierarchy problem, right?
Of course.
So, okay.
But until these models, supersymmetry was the only example of perturbative calculable electric symmetry breaking.
Uh-huh.
This is perturbative calculable electric symmetry breaking without supersymmetry. That's the crucial difference.
Yeah. So, okay, let me try to wrap up quickly.
I didn't understand why the Higgs came up and be a doublet.
Ah, that's. So
okay, is that put in?
It looks like the kaon. That's one way to think about it. So the SU3, if you forget about the SU2 cross U1 here, then they look like adjoints under SU3, but then they break up under SU2 cross U1 into, you know, doublets where the kaons live, and then a triplet for the pions and a singlet for the eta. Okay. So yeah, I could go on and on about how great I think these models are. They have dark matter.
What are the skeletons?
What are the?
Where are the skeletons here?
The skeletons.
No, because
gauge coupling unification, but wait for a paper by Demopoulos and Kaplan.
Yeah. There you go. Are you happy with that? That's not much of a skeleton.
Do your power couplings come from higher dimension operators, or where do you?
So for everything except the top quark, higher dimension operators, no problem. For the top quark, which is, in fact, why the top quark ends up having something to do with the negative mass squared for the left weak symmetry breaking, we want to generate, as you say, a coupling between the left-handed doublet and the right-handed top quark and one of these non-local things that is going to be the Higgs. But if we were to put in directly some non-local thing, well, we're going to reintroduce the quadratic divergences. So you don't want to do that, but that's easy enough to take care of. You actually, say, put the left-handed third family doublet and the right-handed top singlet on this site, and then you can stick on some of the other sites, and there are actually a lot of different ways of doing it, some extra fermions, which are massive. When you integrate those out, they generate this coupling. So it's kind of like Froget-Nielsen, at least in some limit.
And those masses have to be chosen to be more than the electroweak scale.
Well, TeV. Can't be much heavier than that, but...
Okay. And you can
neutrino masses. In principle, no problem. We haven't bothered with them. Nope. But okay. So let's see other good things. Well, I'm not going to. There are lots of good things about this, but you can ask me later, and I'll see if there are any skeletons lying around. Maybe you'll find out that there are skeletons. Okay. So.
Sorry, in the high energy theory, say, in the jazz fields, the dominant has it constructed, or you
There's no problem at all in supersymmetrizing to deal with that. Take this nonlinear sigma model, make it a linear sigma model, where the scale of that nonlinear sigma model is this 10 to 100 TeV. Okay, so that's straightforward. You now have a renormalizable Lagrangian, but you have a naturalness problem. Masses, right? And that you can fix with supersymmetry, but up at this higher scale. Okay, so if you really care about UV completing it, which maybe you do, maybe you don't, then by using supersymmetry, this has decoupled all of the supersymmetric physics from electroweak symmetry breaking, and that's where really all the difficulties.
You probably can.
Well, so there are some.
But you have.
Then it's going to look like Technicolor. You got to deal with etc. But note all of that stuff. The etc. stuff is now happening in a much higher scale. Yeah. So there's no reason you can't in principle. In practice. We haven't tried very hard, but our sort of meager efforts so far have run into some what appear to be just technical problems at the moment. But
that's our fear. If you supersymmetrize, you don't get some other effects at the scale.
No, all of that stuff is happening up at this higher scale at 100 TeV. So I think you're pretty much safe from that.
Is it breaking by how?
Softer, is it 100 TeV?
Yeah.
It completely makes supersymmetry irrelevant for electroweak.
Right, and so it actually makes things like supersymmetry breaking much easier. There's no flavor problem to worry about. You're at 100 TeV. Your question, real quick. So, this one obviously doesn't have the translation invariance. Doesn't look much like an extra dimension. I still said it had two light things, and you're not very surprised because they look like the tiny Wilson lines in this case. In fact,
no, so that's because of the discrete symmetry that only allows the higher order thing.
Yes.
With some assumption about the number of couplings that come in, which has got to depend on
sorry, some... Oh, no, the fact that it went like g squared to the n was guaranteed, just because if any of those...
From the high-energy theory.
From the high-energy theory in this case. That's right. Okay, but just so to answer your question, how do I know that they're always there? If I just gave you a random theory space and said, are there any, could you tell? Okay, and the answer is yes, because it's connected with some of the topological properties of the theory space. So these things with sites and links have topological properties independently of deconstructing an extra dimension. And indeed, it's not too hard to figure out exactly what quantity you compute to see whether or not there are light modes. It is just the analog of figuring out what the Wilson
quantum is. Well, still, have to put in a very small scale, a small number.
Sorry, for...
Well, that number. Jesus, yeah.
This number. Well, so in this case, for example, there's the IR contribution, which we discussed over here, which is the thing that's going to give these scalars a mass, drive electric symmetry breaking and whatnot. And then in addition, there is a UV contribution to the mass, which is suppressed by all four of those gauge couplings. Okay, so in this case, it happens to then, anyway.
I'm sorry, the question which I asked was perhaps slightly different. You hear various statements about the Coleman-Weinberg potential in this five-dimensional case and where it's translational. Some of those statements generalize much more broadly. What I haven't completely understood is how you make a very broad statement that, first of all of the divergent contributions cancel even in the six-dimensional case, or I guess here there are logs because, again, you have two sites in the direction, and how you see the Coleman-Weinberg potential has the form that it, you know, you've got this constant...
Okay, so
good.
So let's take those in order. So the first one is, how do I know that the UV contributions are going to be small? Okay, that
that's
was
basically just power counting like this, right? I mean, the
correct.
Argument, I mean, isn't the argument here about trace U of certain power also controls these divergent pieces down below? No?
Absolutely.
It's the same thing.
That's correct. Okay. And so it really is that argument fancied up a little bit. Okay.
Especially
and
in the Coleman-Weinberg potential, it's that the quadratic divergence isn't there because there's no high dependence on the diagonal.
Right.
It has nothing to do with translational invariance. Of course, when you diagonalize, it looks like some miracle for the spectrum.
Right. So you'll just see a very weird...
Yeah.
Anyway.
So there's some crazy sum rules always.
So okay. Anyway, the observational signal of this is elliptic.
Yeah, so there are a few things, which I didn't go into in much detail. So first of all, of course, to really break the electroweak symmetry, you need not only a negative mass squared for these doublets, you better have a quartic term. The only way to get a quartic term is, in fact, from these structures, requires two Higgs doublets. Can't do it with just one. Not like in supersymmetry. For example, all the fermions can couple to one of them. They can all get their mass from one. They don't both have to get VEVs. But in order to get that quartic coupling, you need both of them. So one of the signatures of this is that there are two relatively light doublets, not just one. So that's one thing. This particular model also has relatively light triplets, weak triplets and a singlet. That's not generic. That's just this particular model. It's easy to construct models where those are not present. You then start seeing these new states, some of which have the same quantum numbers as the things we've already seen, which you might call KK modes, and some which have somewhat different quantum numbers. For example, in this case, there is a spin 1 particle which has the same quantum numbers as the Higgs. That is, it's an electroweak doublet with hypercharge of half. Okay. Their masses are TeV-ish. They're the guys who are coming in to solve the naturalness problem. So you see the physics of those things first, and then, well, if we ever get to above that, you see something else.
They have two Higgs and a bunch of new particles.
And a bunch of new particles at the TeV scale. So unlike supersymmetry, which is going to have new particles well below that, here the new stuff doesn't show up until you get close to a TeV.
You don't get fermions.
Well, there will be the KK equivalents of the fermions, at least for the top quark. As I said, in order to get that coupling to work out, we need to put some extra fermions over there. But again, their masses are on the order of a TeV.
Is there a statement that the spin 1 particle with the quantum number of the Higgs is completely generic? It looks very generic.
The only thing we've really explored in terms of getting the Higgs to be out of the adjoint is this SU3 down to SU2 cross U1 kind of scheme. That will always have this gauge boson with those quantum numbers. But it's not at all clear that that's the only way to get the doublet. So that's why NEMA went like this, just because I suspect that if we tried, we could avoid it. But I don't know.
And you get more interesting things that those groups are G2.
Yeah.
You two, you actually get a prediction for unification. Science by theta equals 0.25.
Right, which is the work that of Demopoulos and little David Kaplan.
So
it's not G2 Holland, it's okay. Yes?
Okay, so you can see how the KK modes cancel off the contributions of the Higgs mass square.
Yes.
Except for the case of the Higgs quartic coupling, I don't see the detail.
I'll do the details for you later. But basically, okay. Note that the Higgs quartic coupling in this case is coming, as I said, you needed the two Higgses, so it comes from this commutator term. Okay. And
would you can see how that term is the Higgs coupling that doesn't give the quartic.
Exactly. Okay. So we can do that. But
did I overhear that you mentioned some light triplets because it's actually the composition of a joint?
In this case, yes, you did hear me say that.
How light?
Oh, they don't have to be particularly light. I think I don't have the numbers offhand, depending upon, I mean, you know, there's some couplings in here, but typically 300, 400, 100 GeV. They don't get BeV, so they're not dangerous for the real parameter.
How generic is your doublet vector for you?
Didn't you just ask that? So the only models we've explored which get these light things out of the adjoint where they naturally appear and produce the doublet that we need for electroweak symmetry breaking are models of this type, different theory spaces, but always SU3 with some sites being SU2 cross U1. In those models, you always get this vector-like Higgs. But there may be other ways of getting out of the adjoint, which would give you something different. Okay, so now Nima mentioned G2 instead of SU3, but that also has this the same thing. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, let me quickly, like in 2 seconds, leave the subject of electroweak symmetry breaking, although I think that these models are really great and very interesting, and just say a few words about some of the other things that have been done with theory space. So in the direction of not trying to deconstruct extra dimensions, we've constructed models of unification at very low scales, 100 TeV, for example, which are quite fun. We have new models of supersymmetry breaking, which in certain regions of moduli space deconstruct Schirk-Schwarz, but in other regions of moduli space just look like something new.
And unification at low energy, you don't need supersymmetry?
We do.
You do.
We want to maintain the success of the MSSM unification for that. Okay. So I should have said that in some regions of moduli space in those theories, it deconstructs power law running, and in other regions of moduli space, it does something different. Slower unification. Recently, Ed Witten has put out a paper where he's looked at the doublet-triplet splitting problem, which has a natural solution in string theory from Wilson line breaking, and realized that it can be deconstructed quite easily. In fact, the model that he ends up producing is an SU5 cross SU5 gauge theory, which does what he wants and is either exactly the same as or extremely similar to an old model by Dvalli and Barbieri. But again, another example where it doesn't have to look much like an extra dimension. And realizes this thing in string theory, which I think many people have been saying can't be done in field theory, but it turns out not to be hard at all just by deconstructing it. There are lots of other things that many people in this room have done, deconstructing gauge mediation, anomaly inflow, stuff like that, which I don't want to talk about. And I want to just mention one other thing, though. In all of those were ideas in the direction of using locality in theory space in limits where they don't look much like extra-dimensional physics, but you could continue just deconstructing extra-dimensional physics to see if it gives you any insight. In the supersymmetric case, life becomes particularly interesting, and since I don't want to talk any longer, I'll just say that one of the things you can do is by taking essentially the circular moose with n equals 2 supersymmetry, you can deconstruct some exotic theories in 6 dimensions, such as the 2-0 superconformal field theory and even little string theory. So even the non-gravitational part of string theory is not hard to get just starting with 4-dimensional field theories. And I think I'll stop there. Thanks very much. How do you get little string theory? Okay, so I don't know. I mean, it's late. Should I?
So let's do 2,0 theory for a second.
Yeah. Really, you want to do these? I don't want to do these in detail.
Do you understand that U1 factors? There's an issue with U1 factors.
there is an issue with the U1 factors, and I think we do understand it. It's a little, my explanation would be kind of labored at this point, but I think it's right. So maybe we can, that's a sort of a technical issue. Maybe we can sit down and just go through it later.
Maybe we could have a smaller
discussion. Yeah.
But
let me do it from this. Let me do it from the string theory side, where it's quick and easy, rather than from the field theory side. But okay. So let's consider strings on an orbifold of a particular kind. So actually, the 2-0 is kind of cooler. So let's do the 2-0. So let's imagine a C2 mod Zn orbifold. Strings propagating on the C2 mod Zn orbifold, and I'll put a stack of k D3 brains, like so. Okay?
You're doing the supersymmetric
C2 mod Zn? Yeah. So, of course, there are moduli in this theory, so I can move the brains off the orbifold fixed point. So let me call that distance d. Now, the first thing is that in the limit that you take the string length to 0, this looks like a four-dimensional field theory. What four-dimensional field theory does it look like? Well, I think everybody here knows that it looks like this quiver theory. I just want to get to the answer quickly, so I'm trying to see what I want to say. Okay, so in this limit, I could just have started with this theory space, the supersymmetric theory on this theory space, and try to figure out what its physics is. There are a couple of important points to keep in mind. It is a superconformal field theory. Just as a 4D field theory, it's superconformal.
If you ignore the U1s.
If I ignore the U1s, absolutely. Okay. It is also one that we expect to inherit an SL2Z symmetry. So, first of all, we have BPS conditions in the field theory, and we have the full SL2Z, which means we can try to make exact statements about the spectrum, at least. And we can do that. I won't go through it. It's actually rather easy to figure out what the spectrum is directly from this string theory. Okay, now, since time is late, I'm not going to go through any of the details. However, we can consider this limit, and the n goes to infinity limit, which corresponds to the deconstruction that we've done here. And I can do that in a way simultaneously while I hold, so this deconstructs naively a five-dimensional theory. So I'll take that limit, n goes to infinity, and L string goes to 0, while holding what would be the five-dimensional gauge coupling fixed. Right? I don't want to take the limit where I lose the five-dimensional gauge coupling. And when I do that, in fact, it takes the lattice spacing to 0. So this is a limit where we get as close as possible to the continuum five-dimensional gauge theory. We know that's not going to happen because we don't believe that theory exists. So what does happen is, in fact, this becomes a six-dimensional field theory. There is, in fact, a hidden magnetic dimension which is formed in addition to this naive electric dimension, which is, in fact, associated with the non-perturbative states. Someone asked about non-perturbative states earlier. Okay. Anyway, those non-perturbative states in the field theory, which we know are there just by the SL2Z, give us precisely the spectrum appropriate for the six-dimensional theory rather than the five-dimensional theory. So this is what first led us to suspect that it was the 2-0 superconformal field theory. Now, we can see it, in fact, from here, because that limit corresponds to pulling the D3 brains far from the fixed point. And in that case, up to corrections which go like order 1 over n, there's no difference between the theory with the fixed point and the theory without it. So just following through the various limits, n goes to infinity, L string goes to zero, and a number of dualities, straightforward dualities, that is the definition of the 2-0 superconformal field theory. Okay. So that was the superconformal field theory. It's kind of cool because you start with this thing, and you actually see that this deconstructs a six-dimensional theory, not a five-dimensional theory.
So the spectrum of W bosons is the KK spectrum for the fifth.
For the fifth dimension, and the monopoles are in the...
is the KK spectrum for the sixth dimension, and exactly, literally
right.
Exactly the same way as the 11th dimension is grown in that theory.
Right.
In the derivation, that's literally what it is.
Okay. So now, the little string theory example is very similar, except the... You start with, rather than this circular moose, you start with, this was an n equals 2 supersymmetric theory. You start with a 2D lattice, n equals 1, which is also superconformal. This one deconstructs naively a six-dimensional theory. Two dimensions are latticized there, and indeed, it is the six-dimensional LST.
And you said n equal 1, how many supercharges
there? This is n equals 1,
so
4.
How many supercharges?
4. It's 4-dimensional, n equals 1.
It's 4-dimensional equal 1?
Yes.
I see. Not 2-dimensional.
No. This is just the theory space. Each of these is a 4-dimensional gauge theory, an SUK, the angles. It's a torus, sorry. It's a toroidal lattice, so I have an n in one direction and an m in the other, and I take both of those to infinity, take the lattice spacing to zero, hold the naive six-dimensional gauge coupling fixed, same deal as before.
In this case, the W bosons are the KK modes of the six-dimensional gauge theory, and the magnetic modes are the winding modes.
Okay. And so, anyway, this thing has solitons, which are the strings of the little string theory.
In the first case, the magnetic modes we're talking about are instantons in a deep four-braid.
Yes.
But these can become small, and then you have to add information to say what that means. We used to think in string theory that meant that in order to define that theory, you really need to start with a 2-0 theory.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little confused about how, before you get to the 2-0 theory, you understand how to deal, for example, with the smallest instantons and the other short distance issues in a D4-braid theory.
Okay, let me give you a naive answer to this question. I don't know the answer to the question. I'm not sure I even understand it. But let me give you a naive answer to what I think. Okay, so let me start with the field theory. Okay, so this is a nice superconformal field theory. I believe we know what that theory does in the UV. Okay? I'm simply going to take a particular limit in that theory. Okay, that is, there's an N, there's a gauge coupling, there's a point in moduli space, the VEV, for those link fields. I'm going to take a particular limit. So what we showed is that, assuming that this theory in the L string goes to zero limit is this, which, setting aside the U1 issues, okay, I think we believe to be true, then that limit over here is precisely the limit which is one of the definitions of 2-0.
Question is, do you have to add degrees of freedom as you take that limit?
No. This is the whole point. So as that circle is shrinking to zero size, normally you'd say, that's not, I've got to add the winding modes, they're becoming light, and so on. Okay. The whole point is that what you would normally think are things you've got to add, the light winding modes, etc., that turn it into 2-0 theory. In this case, exactly those light modes, instead of being interpreted as new degrees of freedom that turn into 2-0 theory, get interpreted as the monopoles of this large n quadrant theory. That's all.
So I'm not sure. I mean, you can start with these instantons of the four plus one dimensional gauge theory. And those are the Kaluza-Klein mechanisms studied, for example, in doing matrix theory on T4.
Yeah.
Okay, but their end result was that in order to define matrix theory on T4, you needed to start with the 2-0 theory.
Exactly, no, but this is what I'm saying. So there's two steps. So the reason you needed to do that is these modes come down, and you've got to add them to the theory that you had, and therefore the description became 2-0 theory.
They're already there. Those instantons are already there. I'm not saying that you had to add the instantons. I'm just saying...
No, you're saying the physics of the instantons really plus this theory is really 2-0 theory.
Right. I mean, the instantons are already there. We all agree that.
Right.
It's just that they have, physics that you don't understand. They're short distances. They're small. You don't know what they are.
In this case, you know precisely what they are because you've embedded it in exactly those degrees of freedom
inside a super conformal field.
So that's one answer to what they might be, but why you necessarily get to the 2-0 theory is not obvious to me. You know, you'd be completed in a particular way with escape theory that might or might not be the way the 2-0 theory would also show this similarity. It's just not obvious to me that it has to be the same. Especially when you throw away some of the stuff like the new ones.
Okay, maybe we can talk about this a little bit.
Is it possible to do conditions?
So, of course, at any finite end, what this gives is some definition for some discretization of Dupont zero. Mm-hmm. But as you take n to infinity, you know, it's just going to look like Dupont zero at energies above the magnitude. So of course, at any fixed end, if you go to some super high energy, you'll discover that it's really a four-dimensional superconformal field theory. It'll stop looking like Dupont zero. But if you take the lattice space into this effective lattice, it's discretized Dupont zero theory. Okay. And so at energies large compared to this effective lattice spacing, it looks like Dupont zero theory. At energies much smaller than this physical lattice spacing, it looks like the physics of this unbroken n equals one superconformal field theory. And in the limit, as you send this effective lattice spacing to zero, it looks like 2, 0 conformal field theory, and on.
So you might try to apply the same argument to any regulated version of four-dimensional gauge theory, right?
No, this is the problem. Yes. Exactly. Beautiful. Yeah. Okay. So the whole point is that we can't naively regulate four plus one dimensional theories and have a sensible ultraviolet theory. That's the whole point of the first part of this law. Yeah, so for example, if you just chopped off the Kaluza Klein box, right, that's not a UV sensible theory.
Yeah.
But if we get those KK modes from the heat snap mechanism in this superconformal field theory, we embedded it in the theory that makes sense out to the short distance. That's the whole point.
Right. This was, in fact, Nima got to make his comment, sort of.
So the only aspect why it is a little bit worse than string theory, it has no gravity, right? Otherwise, it's perfect.
Well, so that's why it's a little bit better than string theory. So the issue with gravity is an extremely interesting one. So let me just make a quick comment, which is that, so note that as far, speaking as a model builder for a minute, one of the things that was interesting here was this locality in theory space where we didn't care much that it looked like an extra dimension. It just had to be a four-dimensional theory which had four-dimensional gravity, which is no trouble putting in four-dimensional gravity in these things, right? And has these phenomena. So what if
sure, but if you just put in four-dimensional gravity, it's still the ultraviolet divergent theory,
sure,
right?
So you get the problems with gravity, but, you know, so anyway. So let's say I like extra dimensions. Do you like extra dimensions? Let's say I like extra dimensions, and I like the gravitational phenomena, at least to some extent. Well, you might have said, just as all we wanted to do was not really deconstruct extra dimensions, which were Lorentz invariant, had the five-dimensional Lorentz invariance and all those properties, we just wanted to get locality, we could do the same thing with gravity. We could say, I don't really care if I get five-dimensional general relativity. All I care about is to get four-dimensional general relativity. Let me finish. Let me please.
Ultraviolet finite, right?
I'm not worried.
Everything else is ultraviolet finite, so in this sense, it's substituted.
Wait. I said I'm speaking as a model builder, so I don't care about ultraviolet finiteness at the moment. I care about building models that are interesting up to, say, 100 TeV. So what I wanted to say was that a lot of this, the gravitational part of, say, the large extra dimension story, you can actually do similar things here by taking four-dimensional gravity and embedding it in something which is local on theory space, relaxing a lot of these constraints. And so that's
clear, but this won't help you to calculate gravity loops.
Absolutely
right?
Not. But nothing to say about that.
Can you really get something that looks like 5D gravity in some region?
Sure.
It's very good. How? You just have lots of different gravitons, you take them down.
Yeah.
Sorry? So let's just say that's when you're isolated. You have a link field, which is a Goldstone boson. The Goldstone boson is now a vector instead of a scalar. And the Goldstone boson
transforms under both, under the general covariances on both sides.
But, like, so it's more, but you cannot pick any length and use two general covariances, because normally we believe that we have one rule, right? Only one, but just hold on.
We're not idiots. So.
Hey, speak for yourself.
So normally it's true that normally you say that if you have two general covariances and you try to write down the most general Lagrangian, you just get two decoupled forms.
Yeah. Okay?
But now we're including fields with very funny transformation properties into the two general covariances, such that I can go to a gauge which sets that field to zero, but where only one general covariance, the diagonal one, is left manifest. Okay? And so what you get out of that theory is one massless graviton and one massive graviton. That's it. And of course, the scale at which this theory becomes strongly coupled is no longer the Planck scale. It's set by the longitudinal components of these graviton interactions become strong at a lower scale. That's what corresponds in the large n limit to the fact that the higher dimensional Planck scale is lower than the effective four dimensional Planck scale. But you can really just make a completely parallel story. Minus, it's even more trivial because we don't even care.
We don't care.
Other people care, but we don't care about UV completing gravity. We just want a low energy effective theory, which breaks down at some scale above a TEV, and which has gravitational interactions in the theory space, such like gravity acts locally. And we can do that. We can get a Kaluza-Klein power of gravitons. But again, as Andy was saying, we can engineer things so we can get a KK power that looks funny. You know, we can change things.
So, but if you don't care about UV completion of gravity, why do you need Kaluza-Klein for the graviton? You can just insert four-dimensional gravity at each side, one and the same
the
gravity.
That's certainly something we can do.
Yeah.
And the only problem with that is in some model building applications, you want all interactions to be local in theory space. Whereas if some interaction is non-local in theory space, it might mess something up. It might generate gravitationally non-local interactions involving a field at this site times a field at that site. Sometimes you don't care about that. Sometimes you do care about that. If you happen to care about that, you can get rid of even this problem by making gravity backward locally.
Yeah. So in this sense, gravity is not much different than the gauge theory, right?
Because it's easier because we don't have the burden of UV completing it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's because you decided not to have this burden.
No, but in this sense, you can do it with, say, gauge fields in higher dimensions too, right? It's the same.
Sure.